Thanks, Bob. Very, very nice to be here. It's a tremendous forum that you have. And looking at your previous speakers, I feel like I might be a AAA player. But having said that, I also would like to tell you that the story of global warming, it's a story of data. And normally I would present data in the form of PowerPoint images, but this is not a particularly good forum for that. So I took my 43 PowerPoint images and distilled them into 12. And I'm going to speak from that. You have a packet on your table. The title of this talk is EPA's Endangerment Finding an Endangered Species. The endangerment finding was a 2009 document produced by the Environmental Protection Agency on Pearl Harbor Day. It was in response to a 2007 Supreme Court case called Massachusetts v. EPA, in which the court held that the EPA could regulate carbon dioxide emissions under the Clean Air Act of 1992 if it determined that carbon dioxide harmed human health and welfare. It was 2007. The Bush EPA just sat on its hands. Obama telegraphed that it was going to be much different. The second substantive paragraph of his first inaugural address said that we're going to do something about climate change. And 90 days after he was inaugurated, the EPA had issued a preliminary finding of endangerment already, which means that it was working on it probably from before the election. And then in December, the final finding went through. The endangerment finding does things like enabling the Clean Power Plan. The Clean Power Plan was such a federal grab of what normally would be legislated that it was stayed in February of 2016, in the Obama administration. It was the last significant act of Antonin Scalia was to be the force behind the stay on the Clean Power Plan. So this endangerment finding is very, very important. And it means you have to demonstrate that CO2, in fact, does endanger human health and welfare. I'll have some ideas about that. The next page I've already gone through. It is the history of the endangerment finding. And that leads us to into the science. The third PowerPoint image is to emphasize that global warming is real. I really have a hard time with the polarization of this issue, where one side says it's the end of the world and the other side says there's no such thing. No, there is such a thing. But take a close look at that graph, because there's really interesting information hidden in this graph. You can see the warming that begins around 1976, and it goes to about 1998, and then it levels out. I'll go into that a second later. And then it pops up there right at the end. That's the big El Nino of 2015, 2016. And then, if you look closely, there's another period of warming. It begins around 1910 and ends around 1945. Well, that could not have been caused by carbon dioxide because we hadn't put enough in the air to do it. The background carbon dioxide concentration is about 280 parts per million in the atmosphere. Today, it's about 410 parts per million. In 1910, when that first warming started, it was only 298 parts per million. It was only 18 parts per million above its background. So if that warming, which is nearly a half a degree, beginning in 1910, ending around 1945, if that warming were caused by carbon dioxide, the temperature would be so sensitive to carbon dioxide that we wouldn't be having this discussion. If a mere 18 parts per million could create that much warming in the early 20th century, then it's very sensitive. So the next graph, the next page, shows the problem writ large. This comes from a paper published by my colleague John Christie and Ross McKittrick. John Christie is famous for having put together the satellite temperature history. This is one of many similar illustrations that Christie has come up with. The colored spaghetti that you see, each piece of colored spaghetti is a climate model. And the red line, thick red line, is the average of all the climate models. These are all the climate models that are used by the United Nations in their last compendium on climate change. There's another one coming out by the end of this year or next year. It's going to use a different set of models. The bottom line, the thick green line, are the actual observations of temperature in the upper tropical atmosphere. It's a very important portion of the atmosphere because the vertical distribution of temperature in the tropics determines how much moisture gets into the air. And the to give you an idea how important that is, 90% of the moisture that falls on American agriculture originates in the tropics. So if you get the vertical distribution of temperature wrong, you get the surface buoyancy wrong, and every forecast of precipitation you can throw out the window. If it turns out to be right, it's right for the wrong reason. Most likely, it's just wrong. So it's a very important thing to do. Now, take a close look at the bottom of that graph. Again, the green line are the observed temperatures from weather balloons. You can see how the very large divergence that develops. By the way, this record begins in 1979 because that's when the satellite became operational. But there is a piece of colored spaghetti, if you can see it. It's the purple colored spaghetti, and it pretty much matches what's been going on. And so, what model should we use, or what models should we use to project future climate? Well, I'll tell you how the way the daily weather forecast is made. I used to teach forecasting. I was on the faculty at UVA for 30 years. Pretty place to work, I have to say. And there are eight climate models, roughly, eight global climate models. Let's say there's a forecast for an East Coast cyclone, a northeaster, could produce a lot of snow in Washington, D.C., and New York. And you know what happens in Washington, D.C. when there's a snowflake in the air. The stores are denuded of bread, tuna fish, and beer. Not necessarily in that order, I might add. What happens is the forecaster does not take all eight models and average them up and say, this is the forecast for the next few days. No. The forecaster looks and says, which model or models is working best in this current forecast situation? What happened the last time there was a northeaster? And in general, by the way, if you are nerdy enough to follow this stuff, and I know some of you are, you will see that we tend to rely upon the European Center medium-range weather forecast model for winter cyclones. It just does better. It also predicted Hurricane Sandy hitting on the New York Bight 7 days in advance. It was quite a good model. You don't take them all and average them up. So what should be the best practice for climate forecasting? The best practice for climate forecasting would be to take that purple line down there. Ah, but we have a problem. We need to call the special prosecutor. The purple line is the Russian model. And the other thing that's interesting, and the other reason we don't use the Russian model, the policy committee becomes entrenched, inbred, and exists to serve itself and to continue making policy. The Russian model has less warming in it than any of the others. It's only got 1.4 degrees Celsius of warming in it for the 20th century, or 21st century, rather. Its sensitivity of temperature to a doubling of carbon dioxide is around 2 degrees Celsius. That's the amount of warming you would get for doubling CO2. The mean UN model sensitivity is between 3.2 and 3.4 degrees Celsius. So the Russian model is about 40% 35 to 40% cooler than the average of the other models, and frankly, would be sufficient to destroy the endangerment finding. So, having said that, where do we go next? Let's take a look in the next chart and to see what's been going on in the recent past. This is the temperature record from the Hadley Center Climate Research Unit at the University of East Anglia. This is the record that scientists tend to use the most because it has the least adjustments done to the data. I mean, you can adjust data all you want and get different answers, but this is pretty much the raw stuff. And what you see, there's a big El Nino there in 1998. That's where it pokes up there. And then there's a La Nina that follows it, which is the cooling period there, 1999, 2000, et cetera. And then all of a sudden, there's no warming. It goes flat. It's called the pause. The last I saw, there were about 60 different explanations in the scientific literature for the pause. When scientists have 60 different explanations for something, we don't know what we're talking about. It happened, okay? And then at the end of this period, you can see the big El Nino of 2015-2016, and that works its way through the system. And then the temperatures are back not quite down to where they were in the pause. And it appears that they are going to stay at that about 0.2 of a degree above where they were during the pause, probably till the next big El Nino. This is something that was not appreciated before. El Ninos are these warmings of the tropical Pacific. And the air, surface air, eventually diffuses up through the troposphere and the stratosphere. So it takes a while for these things to happen. But now it appears that one of the mechanisms of warming, and this does not appear in any climate model because the climate models can't simulate El Ninos very well, is the El Nino is how the excess heat gets into the atmosphere and stays in the atmosphere. And that may be the mechanism that carbon dioxide warming is how it expresses itself. Now, I'd like to switch to some things that I think are what I call more action items. The next page. The next page is a graph of hurricane activity around the globe. It's done by Ryan Maui, a PhD from Florida State University. By the way, if you're interested in atmospheric science, you go to Florida State, especially if you're interested in tropical meteorology, things like hurricanes, etc. And Ryan's PhD was on hybrid storms that look like hurricanes but actually aren't. Very fascinating stuff. He's also a nerd, like me. Maybe more of a nerd than me. And so what he did was he looked at satellite data. We get global satellite data beginning in the year 1970. We get true global coverage. And by looking at satellite, you can see where the storm is, and you can estimate its strength. There is a technique called the Dvorak technique, which, I mean, we don't even fly Hurricane Hunter planes into eastern Pacific storms anymore, because you just look at the Dvorak number and you're within 5 or 10 miles an hour of the maximum wind. And we can estimate the lowest central pressure from the way the eye looks on the satellite. Anyway, so Maui looks at all the satellite data and estimates the winds of the storm and how long they were at the wind. So that gives you a measure of the energy of the storm, wind times time. And he adds them all up year after year for each year and plots them up. Actually does them by month, I'm sorry. And what you see here are 24-month running means of what he calls the accumulated cyclone energy. It begins in 1970 when the satellite goes up. The top line there is the total global accumulated energy. The bottom line is the northern hemisphere, so therefore the area in between them is the southern hemisphere. What do you see? Do you see any change in this? No. The surface temperature warmed up about 5/10 of a degree. If we take count the El Nino, we could say 6/10 of a degree, but it's off that a little bit during this period. And there is no detectable signal in hurricane power. I don't care if someone gets on the television and says, oh, there's more Category 5, 4, and 5 hurricanes. If that were the case, and if they were significant and they lasted a long time, this number would go up. But it doesn't. So that's the reality about tropical cyclones. There is a current myth that they're slowing down and producing more rain when they make landfall. I'd like to see a lot more data on that because the logic behind that is somewhat shaky. It's, oh, sorry about that. I turned it to buzz and I forgot I shouldn't put it on a solid surface where it will buzz. Anyway, the idea is that the global warming warms the high latitudes much more than it warms the tropics. And the jet stream is nature's way of dissipating the energy between the warm tropics and the cold poles. So if the difference is less, then the jet stream becomes weaker. And the idea would be that the tropical cyclones, which are steered by the jet stream when they get mainly on the land, would be moving slower and dropping more rainfall. I say the jury is certainly out on that one, and there's going to be a lot of debate on that. So we really don't know the answer. But the hurricane is a story of adaptation. Galveston, Texas, 7,000 people died in 1900, the largest single natural disaster in the history of the United States. Why? Well, the Weather Bureau at the time didn't quite think it was coming. Ah, wait a minute. The Cuban Weather Service, they're good. They were good back in 1900. And as you know, down here, when there's a tropical cyclone on its way, one of the things you see is a big cloud mass in the direction of the storm. That's the cirrus clouds blowing off the top of the storm. And one of the things you get with a tropical cyclone are spectacular sunrises and sunsets the days before. And the Cubans saw this. And they telegraphed the Galveston office of the National Weather Service and said, hey, you got a big hurricane coming your way. Ah, that's a bunch of dumb Cubans. Our model says our one. No. And they just didn't listen. And they paid the price for not listening. But because of events like that, or the Belgrade hurricane, the 1926 storm down here, people began to adapt. Obviously, we got the technology to forecast them. We put up weather satellites. We put building codes in. And mortality from hurricanes dropped dramatically. Katrina is an exception. That's an example of how political corruption kills people. Those levees in New Orleans, they should have held. They would, if they were designed to spec, they would have held. But no, that was corruption at work. The next image shows you something more, I think, another example. This is the average number of tornadoes in the United States, F3, 4, and 5. That's going down. You know, here are all these stories about, you know, it's going down. There's a lot of noise in the data, but it's going down. I don't know why, frankly. I don't think anybody does. But the number of deaths from tornadoes has dropped dramatically. You look in the early 20th century, things like the Tri-State Tornado, I think it was 1919, killed hundreds and hundreds of people. Nowadays, you'll go through years where there'll be very, very few deaths. This is a story of adaptation to the most powerful small vortex that exists in the atmosphere. In a country that has many more of these than any other place on Earth, the United States is the tornado capital of the world. Next to it, Australia is a far distant second, with Italy being a further distant third. We have a lot of them, and very few people get killed. So that shows that you can adapt to weather and climate extremes. A big buzz was made in the newspaper this week where somebody said, oh my God, sea level is going to rise faster than we thought, and there'll be 120 million people on Earth living below high tide. Right now, the paper forgot to mention something. As we talk today, there are 110 million people on Earth living below high tide. And they're doing just fine. There's a place called the Netherlands, which had a massive flood in 1953 that killed thousands of people. And their response was what any person's, any community's rational response would be. We're going to protect ourselves against this. And say they developed the dike system and the pumping system. And as water rises gradually around the planet, you're going to see more and more and more of that happening. Now, I'd like to close by talking about the world that we're actually living in. The surface temperature is not rising at the rate predicted by the average of those computer models. It's rather, instead of disastrous warming, I call it lukewarming. It is warming. People have something to do with it. That second warming of the 20th century has a human signature on it because it's accompanied by a cooling of the stratosphere. That's a greenhouse signal sign. You know, we're not adding energy to the atmosphere by putting CO2 in it. So if something warms up and the surface will warm because the CO2 molecule absorbs those photons of infrared radiation and re-radiates them, either re-radiates them down, which warms it, or up, goes out to space. So what happens is you warm the surface, you're going to have to cool something else, and you can see the stratosphere cools precisely when the surface temperature warms. In that period, beginning around 2003 or 2004, where it went flat on the surface temperature, guess what? The stratospheric temperature stopped dropping for that period. So not only is it obviously a greenhouse warming, but it's an elegant test of the theory. Karl Popper said, you know, science makes bold, difficult predictions, he called, then it's right, then it's good. And the cooling of the stratosphere is certainly a difficult prediction. So what do we have? We're putting a gas in the atmosphere that's modestly warming the surface temperature. It's feeding plants like crazy. The next image that you have is global food production. That was an old image. I have it. I have the latest data through 2017. I don't know why this one ends in 14. But it continues its low-order exponential increase. Some of that is due directly to the fertilization effect of carbon dioxide. The next image, though, is the one that is mind-boggling. This is the trend in greenness over the surface of the Earth. It's called the Late Leaf Area Index. This is from Nature in 2016. There's been some others that have come out since then. And the color scale is a little confusing, but the magenta colors, where it says 18 and 25 on the right-hand scale, that's where it's greening up like crazy. And take a look at the areas of the Earth that are magenta. The tropical rainforest in Brazil, and the east of the Andes, the tropical rainforest in Africa, and the tropical rainforests of South Asia, and the oceanic islands. The planet's getting greener at a spectacular rate. Now, I can see the question. I know the question always comes. But what if Greenland loses all its ice? After all, the tip of Greenland's Cape Farewell is 60 degrees north. That's pretty darn far south for permanent ice. And so the theory is that Greenland melts. Especially you high school folks, you got to go to Greenland, okay? And go to Ilulissat. You can get a helicopter to go over the Ilulissat Glacier, and it'll drop you off. That's the largest calving glacier in the entire northern hemisphere. It's a spectacular sight. Anyway, so the idea is that it melts in the summer. Greenland's surface is a lot of water in the summer, a lot of open water, and that the water will get down through the ice cap and lubricate the flow of it off the bedrock, and so all the ice will fall off of Greenland in a very short period of time. That would raise sea level about 23 feet if it did that. That would not be good, to say the least. The United Nations currently predicts about 2 inches of sea level rise from Greenland itself by the year 2100. Instead, you'd get 20 feet. That would not be good. So, what we need to do is we need to see if this can happen. Well, in 2013, a paper was published in Nature magazine where a woman heading a team of people who drill cores and ice fields got down to the bottom in Greenland, and they got, you can count them because it melts every summer, so you can count your years like tree rings. And they got past the previous interglacial period. We're in an interglacial period now, began about 10,800 years ago. Then we had the ice, and then there was previous interglacial. And at the beginning of the interglacial periods, it's warmer than it is towards the middle or the end. So it was warmest right after the glaciers receded here in this glaciation, like 6 to 9,000 years ago, probably 1 to 2 degrees C warmer than it is now. But the beginning of the last interglacial, there's a period called the Eemian, which centers around 118,000 years ago, and her core went through the Eemian. It was thought that the Eemian was 2 to 3 degrees C warmer in the summer over Greenland than the 20th century average. Well, you can measure the temperature because you look at the ratio of oxygen-16 to oxygen-18. That segregates depending upon the temperature at which the moisture condenses. And by gosh, the temperature during the Eemian, 6,000 years, averaged, according to Dahl Jensen, never been challenged, 6 to 8 degrees Celsius warmer in the summer for 6,000 years. How much ice did it lose? You can measure the top of the ice from different ice. I think it's a beryllium isotopes that are in it. And it lost, over that 6,000-year period, about 30% of its ice. Okay? What can human beings do? We might be able to warm up Greenland in the summer 5 degrees for about 500 years. So the warming we could do would be 5 degrees times 500 years. That's 2,500 degree years. That's the integrated heat over it. What happened in the Eemian? Let's be conservative. Let's take 6 degrees times 6,000 years. That's 36,000 degree years. It's not going to go away under any scenario that we can come up with. Now, here's the cool part. I told you it was warmer at the beginning of the current interglacial than it is now. We had polar bears. Well, a lady by the name of Margaret Lundquist, I think she's from the University of Washington, was bopping around northern Greenland and came across some bones and said, "I wonder what these are." And there was enough mitochondrial DNA in those bones that they could find out what species it was. They could also date them. The bones were 135,000 years old. In other words, they predated the Eemian warm period. And what were the bones of? Polar bear. So, the polar bear survived the Eemian, 36,000 degree year summers, if you will, over Greenland. So, what I'd like to tell you is we live on a lukewarming planet. The last image is my book, Lukewarming. You know, buy it. It's good. People are using the arguments in it quite a bit. This guy, Michael Schellenberger, who's a big environmentalist, the last column looked like he went through every chapter of Lukewarming. I like that. Anyway, we live on a lukewarming planet. It's going to continue to warm. There's no doubt about that. Anybody who thinks we're going to reduce emissions to zero by the year 2050, that can't be done. It would induce such civil strife, those people would not be in office. You have to have another dense energy source You got to replace it with something. You could replace it with nuclear, except for some reason people who are concerned about this issue don't want to do that. I mean, guy who started this thing, Jim Hansen from NASA, he alienated all his green friends by saying, hey, you don't have to go nuclear. I mean, you can make electric cars, but you have to have something that powers them that's not fossil fuel. It's going to take a lot of energy to run them. So if you're not for that, I would suggest that you're not really particularly serious about this. And I think my time is up. Thank you very much.
I want to thank Pat for a terrific talk. You know, we can all benefit from a few tips on how to deal with hot air.
That's for sure.
And as a modest token of our appreciation, the Forum Club would like to present Pat with our traditional speaker's gift, which two exquisite coffee table books, one of which is on Naples and the other of which is on Marco Island.
Thank you. So lovely book for a lovely place. I appreciate it.
Thanks again, Pat. And now we're going to turn to questions from our audience. And we'll begin with this one. Recently, the UN announced that estimates for climate warming in the future are grossly understated. Could you reconcile that with your presentation?
Yeah, I can. There's a new UN report coming out that has a new series of models in it, and the sensitivity of temperature in those models is about a degree higher than the previous extant one. This one hasn't been published yet, but I've seen them. And John Christie has looked to see if they're making these huge errors in the tropics, and the error is worse. So, people do not understand how you could have such a glaring error propagating through these models and have it persist and not be corrected or not find a way to correct it and to still use those models. That's not science, folks. I got to have another book that just came out a month ago called Scientocracy. And it talks about the corruption of science, not just climate science. It's all over the place. Using models with errors like that, or not using ones that work, that's not science. Unfortunately, that's the direction we're headed in.
We have a question from a student. So are you saying that we should allow the Earth to warm more without attempting to find a way to lessen the human effect on the environment? Do we just let the Earth go through this apparent phase?
That's a very good question. William Nordhaus from Yale won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2018 for his calculation of something called the social cost of carbon dioxide. It's an elegant model. It's pretty complicated. And when he gave his acceptance speech, he sheepishly said, it looks like 4 degrees C is the crossover point between net benefit and net cost. That's a lot warmer than it is now. And you can't count that first warming of the 20th century as being anthropogenerated because we haven't put enough CO2 in the air. When he wrote up his remarks, he changed that to more than 3 degrees C. He fiddled with his model a little bit. Nobel Prize winning model says it warms quite a bit more than the United Nations 2 degrees C before it becomes a net benefit. That's because even in the United Nations reports, what you will see, if I could, what you will see is it's assumed that economic growth is going to be so much that there will be adaptation. Poor societies have problems with weather. Poor societies have problems with tropical cyclones. Affluent societies do not. They have very little problem with it. And the projections that the UN has made is that basically countries, say, in sub-Saharan Africa will have the average wealth of, say, the United States around the year 1980 by the time we get to 2100. So the societies will become more resilient. But then there's something else in this question that I think is very interesting. I can't predict the energy structure of this society 50 years from now, nor can anybody in this room with any confidence. And I'll give you an example why. If this were Washington, D.C., God bless if it isn't, thank God. If this were Washington, D.C., and we were having a stand-up cocktail party, and it was 12 years ago, so 2006, and we were talking about, we were all bemoaning the fact that we're running out of natural gas. The price of natural gas was really high. And you know what that meant? That meant we're going to have to build more coal-fired power plants because that's a substitute for natural gas. And if I had a few, so people wouldn't believe what I was saying, I said, well, you know what? That's all a bunch of bull. We have hundreds of years of natural gas, hundreds, at increasing consumption rates, and all we have to do is break rocks. I'd be thrown out of that polite society. But that's what happened. That's why you can't make those glib predictions. The one that I will make is maybe a little bit humbler. I know 50 years from now or 100 years from now, the way we produce energy is going to be radically different than it is today. I don't know what it is, but it's going to be different. We don't even know what gravity is, for God's sakes. I think there's probably a lot of power in gravity, for example. Lots of things we don't know. And so I view the carbon dioxide era as probably something inherent in our technical evolution. Just can't see it going on forever. Somebody's going to come up with something. Next.
Next question. How do you account for the fact that the European models, specifically the Russian model, seem to be more accurate than the U.S. model?
Oh, that's a very good question. The European model, that's the European model for medium-range weather forecasting. That's not a climate model. It has a better ocean, frankly, in it than our model. The Russian model, the Russian climate model, the one that predicts essentially the lukewarming world, has an ocean that has twice the heat capacity of all the other models. In other words, if the downwelling energy changes X amount, the Russian model only warms up half as much as the other models. Now, you can say, well, whoa, that's weird. Why are you using a model that's an outlier? Well, here's something cool. That model is called INMCM4. INMCM5 is now on the street, and it's been developed for the new United Nations report. INMCM5 has the pause. It simulated the pause in warming that occurred in the early 21st century. None of the others can do that. And it's the one that's got the least warming.
We have now a couple of questions that have local significance that we hope you can comment on. What's the relationship between climate change and Florida's red tide and blue-green algae? What should be done to fix the problem? And a second local question, what's your view on sea level rise? Will Naples be underwater in 50 years? Or is that a hyperbolic myth?
The first one, I've heard different explanations for the red tide. I do have a degree in plant ecology, but it certainly wasn't an algae. So I'm gonna stay away from that one. With regard to will Naples be underwater in 50 years? No. Sea level rise is gradual. It's even unclear whether the satellite measurements are accurate. You take tide gauges from around the world, you see a few inches of sea level rise in the 20th century. And even if that rate doubled, you can adapt to a foot and a half of sea level rise in 50 years, I assure you. I mean, it doesn't even put you below high tide. And the Dutch, you know, like I said earlier in the talk, they had a disaster. The disaster spurred them to action. And I think the same would happen down here. It's just remarkable what people can do when they want to work together for the good. Also kind of remarkable what they can do when they want to work together for the bad.
Next question, can you comment on plans to capture, convert, and create a fossil fuel from carbon dioxide?
Biofuels. What do you think the morality is? We produce more corn than anybody else on Earth. What do you think the morality is of taking 40% of that corn and using tremendous amounts of energy to distill ethanol from it, isn't used for food? I mean, some of the stuff that's left over is used for low-grade cattle feed. But it's doubtless that that raises the price of food worldwide. And it's carbon dioxide. It's not carbon dioxide. It doesn't reduce carbon dioxide. Life cycle, it's probably weakly negative, meaning it costs a little bit more carbon dioxide. I'll tell you that about plants. I'll tell you, this story gets mixed up in emotion and hidden agendas. In Europe, there was a move for sustainable energy. And a power plant was built called the Drax plant, D-R-A-X, in the United Kingdom. What powers it? Let's go clear cut some loblolly pine, and then we're going to turn it into wood pellets. And then we're going to ship the wood pellets to Norfolk, Portsmouth, or Baltimore, and put all these pellets on board an ocean-going ship. Send the ship to England. Burn the wood pellets for power. And you know what we're going to say? That's sustainable. Right. Takes 75 years to regrow a loblolly pine, okay? Then you'll get your carbon dioxide back out of the atmosphere. Yeah, it's sustainable on a 75-year horizon. I think on any practical horizon with regard to carbon dioxide emissions, it's ridiculous. But that's the kind of thing that we do when politics interferes with the science. Sorry, I'm grumpy today.
And our final question. Can you comment on deforestation of the Amazon and the effect of icebergs melting at the poles?
Two things. I'll take two questions. Again, your image there, the satellite imagery, shows that the greenness of the tropical rainforest, particularly in the Amazon, the greening up of it is greater than anywhere else on Earth. Now, when you talk about deforestation, you're talking about turning portions of the tropical rainforest into agricultural land, land that produces pretty well for a year or two, and then it requires substantial soil supplementation because there's not a lot of nutrients in that soil. That's called slash and burn agriculture is what it was, where the local residents slash down the forest, burn it, and they do get some nutrients out of the trees they burn. If you leave it alone, you know, for another God knows how many years, it'll come back to something like a tropical rainforest. But it's not, I don't know, there are better ways to produce things. I've always been a little queasy about that. But thank God we're greening up the stuff that's there, and there is a lot of it there. Icebergs at the poles. Mystery story. Okay, North Polar ice. Satellite records began in 1978 for North Polar ice, microwave sounding satellite. And you can see, let's see, I'm going to do the graph this way. Yeah, you can see it's going down. It begins here around 1978, and then it goes down to about 2008. This was the lowest ice of the summer. One problem, people don't notice. In 1978, when that satellite went up, the Arctic was at the end of its coldest period since the mid-1920s. And so the ice was expanded when the satellite went up. In fact, that was one of the rationales for putting the ice up. Hey, the Arctic ice is expanding. We want to be able to monitor this. And then, of course, people realize that this little carbon dioxide issue is coming along, and so you get a decline in the ice. About 2008, it looks like the low point sort of leveled off. It's certainly a lot lower than it was. But I mentioned earlier that from 6 to 9,000 years ago, at the beginning of our interglacial, it was a couple degrees warmer than it is now. And there's strong evidence in several papers that the Arctic Ocean was ice-free for many of the summers 3,000 years ago. And certainly during the Eemian, with that 6 to 8 degree warming, it had to be ice-free at the end of every summer. That's why I showed you the picture of the polar bear. It's a much more resilient animal than you might think. That's melting sea ice. That does not raise sea level. Put some ice cubes in that glass of water, check the level, and when they melt, the level's going to be the same. What you're concerned about is land ice. Land ice from Greenland, land ice from Antarctica. And the current religion is it's really hard to have much of a net loss of land ice in Antarctica, because you warm up the Southern Ocean, which surrounds Antarctica, even a slight amount, that increases the moisture flux into the air, and then that precipitates over Antarctica if a cyclone moves through the area. You think that falls as rain? Nuh-uh. And there is now evidence finally beginning to accrue, much later than people thought it would, that Antarctic snowfall is increasing. I think you're going to hear a lot of stuff, yes and no, about Antarctica forever. There's just too little that's known. But the one implication of the Greenland study that showed that it didn't lose all that much of its ice in the Eemian, we know that sea level went up 25 feet in the Eemian, but 30% of Greenland went, that's 30% of 20 feet, that's 6 feet. Where did the rest of the ice come from? Well, it had to have come from Antarctica. Anybody know how it got off Antarctica? What came off of Antarctica? The answer is there are three most important words in life. They're not "I love you." I don't know. And there's a lot of things we don't know.
I want to thank you all very much for your attention. A big round of applause for Pat Michaels. Please remember to leave your name tag.